lesson by Henry Hazlitt. I highly recommend it. It's been used in extemp for decades. You think, well, how good could it be? It's a 50-year-old book. You know, how current could it be? Well, if you look through it, most of the crises and issues he talks about are pretty much the same today as they were, 5 decades ago. Hazlitt has one simple lesson that he presents, one economic concept, and then he applies it to, 20, 30 different areas of the economy. So I'll talk about that, and that's the sort of overview I've chosen for this session. So how many of you, maybe I asked this already, how many of you have taken economics courses? One? A couple? Okay. And economics can be tricky because if you take AP economics, advanced placement economics, online or at a local community college or college, there's lots of different styles of economics. There's different things people emphasize. There's economists. I mean, Karl Marx was an economist. So that gives you a sense of the range. You can promote communism, which is basically an economic theory. You can promote market ideas as well, with a lot of different economists, a lot of different perspectives. But most economists agree on a few basic principles. And one of the challenges with economics is it's an easy subject to teach. If you go on and get an economics degree, take a bunch of economics classes, somebody asks you to teach it, you just turn around and throw the same stuff back at people that you got. Sort of like debate, right? You can do debate for a couple years, you can, run a debate camp because you've learned the things from other people. But the challenge is, in economics, so much jargon, statistics, and junk are thrown at people, things that graduate students are fascinated with, that people sort of get distracted about what's important and what isn't. So the argument, it's the teaching of economics suffers from trying to do too much. Now, in extemp, you're not doing, if you're using economics, you're not really doing economic theory, overall economic theory, as much as you are applying economic theory to public policy issues, to current events. So you'll find there's a bunch of great economics books, economics and public policy. They're usually readers for the classroom use, where they'll look at specific public policy issues. The most popular book recently was called Freakonomics. Soon the new book called Super Freakonomics is coming out. I'm not a fan of that book, for various reasons, but it's an interesting sort of application, people using economics to try and sort of explain why things work the way they are. So, a lot of technique, we're better off using examples, and current events and public policy issues allow you to do that. Economics is a way of thinking about the world. So, here we go, basic economics. I was going to say the first concept is scarcity, and I realize I don't have an eraser. So they're talking about scarcity with erasers right off the bat. Anybody have an extra sock? What did they use for the eraser before? Anybody know? Anything cloth would be fine. But wait, no, I've got some. So in economics, there's just a few basic key concepts. And the first key concept is sort of the nature of the world and the concept of scarcity. In other words, there aren't enough of everything to satisfy everyone. So right now in the middle of the healthcare debate, they're saying, look, there's a scarcity of healthcare or medical care. There isn't enough medical care in the status quo to provide everyone with all the medical care they might want. There's not enough food for everyone to eat everything they might want. There aren't enough cars. If you were to make a list of everything you'd like to have, the thing you want most at the top and right down the line, there's not enough of all those things for everyone to have everything. Now, that doesn't mean that that's just being greedy and materialistic. You could put, violin lessons or debate classes or books or theoretical things. You'd like more money to give to charity, all sorts of things. There's not enough of all that for everybody. So basic concepts, the nature of the universe, right? Now, because of the scarcity that each of us face personally and society faces, we have to make choices. In other words, you've only got so much money, you have to make choices about what you spend your money on. Even if you're super rich like Bill Gates, he's got virtually unlimited amount of money, but he has to make choices about what to spend on because he's only got so much time. He could be buying stuff, he could have 18 computers buying things, with super purchasing programs on the internet, he still couldn't spend all his money. Right? So, he has to make choices about what he spends his time doing, even though he doesn't have a scarcity of money, he's got a scarcity of time. In any case, we have to make choices, and economists use the concept of opportunity, because we have to make these choices, every choice has a cost, and economists call that an opportunity cost. Okay, so what did it cost you to come to this camp? Well, it cost you a certain amount of dollars, but it also cost you time, right? You could have been working someplace else, you could have been doing separate research, you could have been hiking. So the sort of the core idea is scarcity leads to choices, choices lead to costs, and costs are defined in terms of what you give up. Every time we choose, you know, to do one thing, you chose to come to this session that I'm giving. What's the cost?
Can't get it out of there.
Yeah, you're missing everything they said. Right, so the people in there are facing a much higher cost. Right? But every choice we make has a cost. That's the core point. And this, of course, the application to government is every government program has a cost. Has a cost not only in other government programs that can't be run because they're spending on this one, but also, since the government doesn't have its own money, the cost is what people would have done with the money if it hadn't been taxed away by the government. Or what people in the future would have done with their money if they didn't have to pay it to pay the debt incurred by the spending now. So this concept of opportunity cost is like the core concept. So in every extemp topic, every debate round, all environmental policy has vast costs, which are what the money and effort, what could have happened if the programs, particular programs weren't spent. So that's sort of, you know, the standard basic ideas. Opportunity cost, opportunity cost, opportunity cost. So economics in one lesson, Henry Hazlitt's book, is basically about opportunity cost. And Hazlitt starts it with a story by Frederick Bastiat. And I turn the story into a story about a debater. But basically, it's a debater or extemper who's been an extemp round, and he thought he won. He comes out, he finds out he's lost. He's furious, he blames bad judging, and he goes out on the street and just in his anger picks up a rock and throws it. The rock smashes through the window of the area baker, and the glass comes down all over the baker's shop. The baker, you know, wonders what's happened, goes out, finds this debater and grabs him, and a crowd gathers, and so here's what's happened. The baker says, "You smashed my window, you know, you're a ruffian, you're a bad person," and all this. So the debater, though, the extemper, he's got certain skills, right? He's got speaking skills. He's quick on his feet. So he says, "Well, wait a minute. You're mad at me for breaking this window. But think about it. The window's broken. You're going to have to get a new window from a glazer, the guy that makes windows. He's going to get income that he otherwise wouldn't have. This is new business. With this extra money he gets, he'll spend it. He'll go out to dinner, buy some clothes, go on vacation. Those people will have money that they never would have got. Thanks to me, thanks to you, and we will be stimulating the economy. You shouldn't be mad at me, but we'll help get America out of this recession, right? By all this new economic activity, the ripple of economic activity spreads out through the economy, creates jobs, income, wealth. It's good for everyone. So what's the fallacy? What's the broken window fallacy? This extemper is claiming that this is a benefit. Yeah.
Doesn't the baker lose business because that broken window?
The baker loses, he loses the window. He has to spend money on it, but that has benefits throughout the economy, the multiplier effect. So this is the concept of opportunity cost, what Bastiat calls the seen and the unseen. What's seen are all the benefits that come from fixing this broken window, the new jobs, the new income, and all that. What's unseen is what would have happened in this parallel universe if the window hadn't been broken. The baker might have gone out to dinner, might have bought some clothes, or even if he left the money in the bank, that would be used, loaned out to others. So we hear in the news, the Cash for Clunker program's great. Tons of sales, automobile companies are humming, everything's booming, new jobs created, the economy's lifting up. So that's the seen, all the benefits that come from Cash for Clunkers. What's the unseen? Yeah.
The government took taxes to pay for that, and the American people could have spent that money on other things within the economy that would stimulate.
All right. So the money had to come from someplace. Now, if the money was better spent smashing old cars, which is essentially what Cash for Clunkers does, takes cars that work and smashes them, if that's good for the economy, you know, what we don't see is the other side. So either the tax money taken now, or since the government's deeply in debt, this is borrowing. So this money is coming from China and other people that are saving around the world. They're sending that money to us so we can smash our old cars, and in the future, you will be paying taxes in order to pay them back for the loans they gave us to smash cars. So that's the plan. So in any program, you have this sort of standard opportunity cost, so that you could call it the seen and the unseen, or the opportunity cost, or the broken window fallacy. You know, generals would often say, we need this new tank, or the F-22 is in the news now, right? A lot of people want to cancel it. And so they say, we need this airplane, and not only do we need the airplane for the military, but it's going to create thousands of jobs. Or if you cancel it, all these jobs will be lost, and all these bad things will happen. The defense of a new airplane for the Air Force has got to be in the military value of it. All the economic ballot, quote-unquote, benefit is false or misleading, right? That is to say, it's a trick because it's seen, it's true, benefits come. But what we don't see is where the money comes from. Make sense? No. Okay. All societies face this problem of scarcity, whether it's a tribal society or a traditional society. Ancient societies had this problem, or communist societies have this problem, market societies do, and they all have to deal with it in different ways. How do you deal with scarcity with a traditional society? Well, you have traditions. You have rules. You know, people, the village leader decides, or you do it the same way you used to. In a command economy, people at the top make the decisions, right? The leaders of Russia decide how much is going to be spent on this or how much is going to be spent on that. In Cuba, the government decides how much is going to be spent on healthcare. Market societies, the way those decisions are made in market societies is more complex, and that's what we talk about when we describe economics. The next areas we talk about in economics are supply and demand. And, you know, basic idea I use, the example I sometimes use, this book, Spiritual Enterprise, Doing Virtuous Business. It's by Ted Malik. It's a great book, full of insights. I highly recommend it. It's yours for only $25. How many want a copy? Hardback, lasts forever, good paper, acid-free. Okay, what if I drop the price to $20? $15? A couple copies for $15. What if I drop the price to $10? How many want a copy? Okay. If I drop it to $5, pretty blue cover, it'll look nice on your bookshelf. $1, drop it to $1, how many wants one? You know, you might buy a lot more, sell them at a debate tournament. Well, the idea here is simply this is the law of demand. The law of demand says there's a relationship between the price of something and the quantity of that good or service demanded. As the price goes down, the quantity goes up. I mean, it's not a brilliant insight. It doesn't seem to be. Price goes down, quantity demanded goes up. And that's because as the price goes down, the opportunity cost goes down. At $25, you're giving up a lot of other stuff to get this book. But at $5, you know, you're not giving up so much, so you're willing to buy more. Let's say I'm selling the book for $5, not $1. As the price goes back up, the quantity demanded, you know, goes back down. So any product you name, there's a relationship between the price of something and the quantity of that good or service demanded. Now, it's true that some things with low prices seem cheap, so we don't want them. You know, when you go out to buy a wedding ring, you know, don't buy one for $100, even though it looks nice. There's problems with wedding rings that just cost $100. So people aren't going to buy more of those just because they're cheap. But by and large, if things seem of equal value, people are going to buy a lot more of them if the price goes down. Right? Simple. Straightforward. So that's the law of demand. Law of supply, the other half. Let's say I do research for my website. I invite students to help on the research. Let's say I'm willing to pay... Well, if you're interested, you want to work on the website, I'm willing to pay $3 an hour for website research. How many of you want to spend some time doing that? Couple. One. What if I raised it to $5 an hour? Almost legal, right? What if I went up to $10 an hour to pay you to debate research and extemp research? $20 an hour? $30 an hour, you drop out of extemp and spend all your time doing research. Right? So the same sort of thing here is the price of something goes up, the quantity of that good or service supplied goes up. And since I don't really pay $30 an hour for research, I'm afraid if the price goes down, the quantity supplied goes down. So we have a basic, you know, model of supply and demand. And this applies to goods and services throughout the economy. This is a coordinating effect. You find this every year. You know, when the apples are ready in the fall, apple harvest comes, apple prices go down, lots more people buy apples because they're cheap, right? So the laws of supply and demand apply throughout the economy. However, when government sets constraints on this, you know, price controls, like when the gas crisis came in the 70s, they said, we're not going to allow prices to handle supply and demand. They put a lid on prices. Nobody can charge more than, you know, X amount. They put a cap on it. Well, how does the market handle it when you restrict prices? You know, what's the influence of that? So we have in the history of the U.S. all sorts of price controls. We had wage and price controls, gas price controls. There's usually calls saying, look, the price of gasoline's too high. We've got to put a constraint on it. And that causes other problems. Okay, supply and demand, basic economic concept. Just a little bit of the history. The first big book on economics sort of launches the field is by Adam Smith. And I'm going to mention it because for international extemp, for students that, you know, any kind of international topic, the concepts from Adam Smith, this was published in 1776. It's still a great book. It's amazing. You can open it up and find sort of fascinating things in it. But Adam Smith wrote this because something strange was happening that had never happened before, as far as he knew. In Scotland, where he lived, Scotland was getting wealthier. Scotland, in the late 1700s, was prospering. People were living better than their parents, and they were living better than their parents. They had better houses, better food. Scotland, interestingly, in the late 1600s, was one of the poorest places in all Europe. It went from being the poorest country in Western Europe to being the wealthiest country in a little over 100 years. So in the late 1700s, Scotland is prospering. The early 1800s, it becomes the wealthiest place in Europe. And how did that happen? It's sort of a puzzle. What led to this prosperity? And that's what he writes about. What's the nature of wealth, and what are the causes of wealth? Why did Scotland get wealthy? And basically what he's fighting against is government control of the economy, a concept of mercantilism. Mercantilism was the view that the leaders of the countries of Europe, France, England, Spain, had to decide, set policy on. They were always trying to get more gold, the monetary policy. They were deciding what sort of businesses could be allowed and who could get permits. And that process, Adam Smith argued, just didn't work, made the country poor. You're much better off, he said, by having the government not involved in the economy and just letting people start businesses and trade as they wanted to. So these principles he talked about basically were very influential in the United States. The founding fathers, Jefferson and others, were taught by Scottish teachers, and they are all part of this Scottish Enlightenment, which are basically these free market ideas that infuse Scottish society and spread around the world. So that's enough history of that. But that concept really becomes the core of what is today macroeconomics. Macroeconomics has become the study of how countries prosper, why countries prosper. I think I'll show a clip in a few minutes. Of, I don't know how many of you have seen, Gregory Mankiw is one of the leading economists at Harvard, a textbook publisher, has a blog, influential, and he's got these 10 principles of economics. And I've got a video clip of another economist explaining these 10 principles, sort of making fun of them, but making some comments that I think will be valuable. It brings up the question, why do economists disagree so much? Why do economists that are supportive of the Obama administration come out with all these studies and theories saying what he's doing is good, while others come out and say it's terrible? Why is it so? I mean, you don't have this in physics. So the distinction between power and liberty. And this, if you read what the founding fathers wrote about Madison and Jefferson and the pamphlets that the founders wrote, they were always concerned with power and liberty. And you find the rhetoric, in fact, scholars that go back and look at these the pamphlets of the founding era today, they say that these guys were like psychotic. They were so concerned about power. They had all this imagery of like power being this grasping hand reaching out and strangling people, and liberty being this flower that needs to be protected. But the founding documents, the Constitution, the Declaration, Bill of Rights, are concerned about power. And one reason for this has to do with religion. You know, the people in the founding era were generally Christians, and they had a view of man as fallen, right? Man who does the best he can, but, you know, makes mistakes. People with power, power tends to corrupt, the argument Lord Acton said. You see this in The Wizard of Oz, by the way. Remember that in The Wizard of Oz, when they're confronting the great and powerful wizard and all the smoke and commotion is going up, and Toto pulls the curtain back and they see that this guy is making all this happen. And Dorothy comes up to him and confronts him, and he said, "You're a very, very bad man." What's his response? He says, "No, I'm a good man. I'm just a bad wizard." I'm a very bad wizard. So people in power make mistakes. Barack Obama might be the greatest guy in the world. He seems like a really nice guy. But in power, all of a sudden he has vast control over the economy, and he has lieutenants who give him more control. And so that kind of power is not for man, for various reasons. And much of what goes wrong in the economy is with people in power.